The year is 1985, and we are introduced to Rocky Dennis, a young man who defies the expectations of doctors and society through his intelligence, warmth, and determination to live a normal life. Helping him make his way through life is his mother, Rusty, whose deep bond with her son forms the emotional center of this tearjerker of a movie. Set against the backdrop of Southern California's biker subculture, Mask balances emotional intensity with moments of humor and hope, challenging conventional notions of beauty and ability, and emphasizing acceptance and the importance of community. Eric Stoltz is unrecognizable underneath the prosthetics, while Cher, starring as Rusty, delivers a raw and compassionate portrayal, which earned her a Best Actress Award at the Cannes Film Festival. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover Peter Bogdanovich's film, Mask. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. And you know me, I'm not a big tearjerker guy, but I'm the one that brought this episode to the table because if I had to think of a tearjerker film of any decade that made me well up inside and make me just so mad at society, but also feel like I could conquer the world based on the courage of a character in a film, it's this one. I might say that this might be like my favorite tearjerker drama of the 80s. A lot of people would say Terms of Endearment. This was more my style. The bikers are great. Sam Elliott rules. Cher is incredible. And for me not being the world's biggest Eric Stoltz fan, maybe he is better behind a mask because his performance really just bleeds through the prosthetics, like I said earlier. So all in all, I'm a huge fan of Mask. But what about you?
You know, this is one of those weeks that I wish I had your critic under my belt. And without giving too much away, he does kind of nail it on every feeling that came through to me during the rewatch. And I haven't seen this movie in a couple decades. So
it's been a while.
It's been a while. And this is one where I'll just give the snippet where after me and you, we watch a lot of movies and we've seen a lot of tearjerkers and we kind of get used to that. We get almost that wall, if you will, that our critic will speak to later. And this one was just as effective as a first time watch. And I think it's mainly due because we don't have just our Rocky character driving this movie. It respects all the ensemble here. It respects an emotional element, the mask element of all the characters on screen, where we don't have a focus on a deformity. We have a focus on characters. And this one, you're 100%. It's a tearjerker, but it's a tearjerker that doesn't focus on just one element. It focuses on the entire cast. And that's what makes it so effective here. And almost to perfection, it really does drive this movie on some feel-good elements. It's almost a balance of feel-good tears that end in a crescendo of just bawling.
You know, and it's funny because, you know, I mentioned Terms of Endearment, which I will say that's probably like one of the most recognizable tearjerkers of the 80s, especially like the last act with Shirley MacLaine begging for the medicine, right? It's become, this is my point. You would think that because of how cliche and stereotypical the ending of Terms of Endearment is, that it would be ripe for parody. Yet, Mask is the one I feel that is parodied the most in shows like Family Guy and The Simpsons and sketch shows from the 90s. Like, for some reason, of course, you know, people always punch down in the 80s and 90s when it comes to satire and parody. But I saw more humorous renditions of Mask than I did Terms of Endearment, yet Mask never takes itself too seriously as a tearjerker. And I give that 100% to Bogdanovich. Bogdanovich generally leans more into humor and quirkiness than he does drama. And here he has a nice blend of both, where we can tell a dramatic story, yet like you said, we have very colorful characters that are written well, but they're also performed well and directed well. And so what I think what he was trying to do with this film, the way I interpreted it, is that we don't see a lot of, let's say, normal society. We are immersed in this colorful group of bikers, Rocky and his friends, his mom with her drug addiction, which, again, I give this movie its credit where they don't make that the main point of the movie. It's literally just a character element that adds to how interesting Rusty is. It's not all about Rusty's drug addiction, which would be really easy to go that route as well. We've got Bulldozer, the very cute, cuddly, big teddy bear of a biker who also doesn't really fit the norm because he doesn't talk. For a side character who gets a great moment of his own, that brings a lot of credibility to this movie, where it's a drama that is going to make you feel good at the end. Pretty much everybody gets a happy ending, and even though there is a tragic ending for our main character, it's how he affected other people's lives. Even the life of a prostitute that his mom brings home makes her life better. That is one of the things I think this movie has in spades above other tearjerkers of the 80s.
Well, I think that's what makes this movie separate itself from every other cliche that we see, because we are so invested in the characters. We are so invested into the internal conflict of each and every character, where there's no zero in on any of the conflicts. We know they're present. It's driving the movie. It really is a proper balance. But by the time we get to the climax, we really almost forget that there could be or is a tragic event that could happen. We just are almost taken by surprise because we are so engulfed into the human nature and the internal and external conflicts of these characters that we don't see it coming. At one point, I even forgot. I was so engulfed into this rewatch and just focusing on the characters. Is when we finally do get that outcome, I was still taken by surprise on where this came out of. It almost, I was watching it with my wife, and she was pissed off that it was so rushed that we didn't get that cliche climax. We didn't expect it. And that's what I loved about this movie, is it doesn't go to the proper tropes of trying to really just stab you in the heart and say, this is something you should feel. It was an earned ending. And even though some may argue that this was kind of a rushed climax, I absolutely loved it.
Well, and this is where like Cher really earns more credibility with me, because I've always thought she was an amazing actress. And I'm not saying that like people thought she was a bad actress. I think people thought she made some subpar films, but she was never bad in them. She's almost always the best part. I mean, we already covered Mermaids in our show, and you gave her Best Actress for last year of all the episodes that we did. And granted, that was a great choice, great performance. She does something in this film, in that moment, in the end of Tragedy. And I'm going to take a second and go back to compare to Terms of Endearment again, where that last 30 minutes of the movie, we have to suffer in the hospital with Shirley MacLaine. So it's a buildup to that emotional breakdown, right? In this, it feels more realistic, especially in the sense of the condition that Rocky Dennis had, where he was perfectly fine the day before, had a little headache at night, and then didn't wake up in the morning. And because they were already laughing at death from moment one, that first scene in the hospital where she's like, yeah, all my life and all his life, doctors have been saying, oh, he'll be dead in a month, he'll be dead in a year, blah, blah, blah. And here he is, 16, 17 years old, and he's still with us, and he hasn't let the doom and gloom of his imminent demise take over his life. So when she has that moment when she opens the door, she does something with her eyes where she just kind of looks up because she understands what the situation is. Yet she keeps going with the routine. We need to open the blinds. We need to get you dressed. Like, she knows what is going on. And that makes, to me, that performance more memorable and heartbreaking than the Shirley MacLaine performance, because it's not theatrical. It's not sobbing. It literally is Rusty. That's who she's built this character to be the entire film. And she doesn't break the mystique of that character. She keeps it in line. And I think it's a combination of direction and performance, but that could have gone so cliche, so overdramatic, and it just played so well. And that's why I think it's a perfect ending to a movie where it is sad and tragic, but at the same time, we are with her. The strength that she's had to build up over this kid's life to keep him alive, she keeps with her through that final moment. Definitely earned that award for Cannes, and it blows my mind that it was not recognized by the Academy that year.
100%, because there is a moment that even during my rewatch, we get to the doctor's office and it can easily go with Rocky where we're going to get this cliche moment of you only have such and such time to live, or you're going to have this emotional moment that every other movie is going to take advantage of the doctor's office. But it doesn't go that route. You even have kind of the new doctor that is the new guy that goes against the rhythm, goes against the formula, and it doesn't focus on it. It kind of makes it situational to the point saying, this is the kind of movie we're going to make where it's not going to be predictable. We're going to move on and stay true to the community aspect, to the conflicts of these other characters, and we are going to earn what's going to happen at the end. And when it comes to Cher, this is where typecasting goes right. That's who she is. That's what she's comfortable with. And this is where it really does go right. And this is the backbone of where she's really built this powerful character. This one, I will always go back to the Cher performance, because she did deserve an Academy Award for this, because it is a believable performance. It never breaks. Even all the way up to the climax, it's believable, where we have a mother that's strong but weak at the same time, and it shows her vulnerabilities, and we don't need those vulnerabilities explained to us, because as humans, we understand, and Cher got that in this performance, and it's absolutely brilliant.
There's something magical, too, about the chemistry between people in this movie. I mean, the chemistry between Sam Elliott as Gar and Cher as Rusty is just magnetic. Like, I don't think I've seen better chemistry between the two of them in any film than what they have together. And on that same note, the chemistry that Eric Stoltz has with a very young Laura Dern, who plays a blind girl, you know, they only share maybe like 10 minutes of screen time together, but that chemistry is really intense. Then you have, in the Biker Club, you've got Nicole Mercurio as Babe and Harry Carey Jr. as Red. And they're only in it for a minute, but they're like the older biker couple, right? And they have a great chemistry as well. Richard Dysart and Estelle Getty as the parents. One scene, you know, so maybe like what, 5-6 pages of dialogue in the whole movie? And they feel genuine. So I got to give props, A, to Bogdanovich for his direction, but whoever cast this movie did an amazing job recognizing chemistry with the main people who are paired up in it. Very rarely do you see this kind of chemistry work amongst everybody. And even in the friend group, you know, I'm heartbroken because we have his best friend, Ben, played by Lawrence Monison. If anyone knows Gary, who gets his heart broken in The Last American Virgin, this guy is just born to be heartbroken. And he plays a character that he is Rocky's best friend, and they have a breakup. They have a friend breakup. And that moment is almost as heartbreaking as a romantic breakup, because Rocky knows that his time on Earth is limited, and he has one big dream, and that's to bike through Europe. He's got a map where he has all his little push pins to say where he wants to go, and he's going to go there with his buddy Ben, who chooses a job in another state with him. And that's a tragedy, because Rocky knows that once that guy leaves, he'll never see him again, because he knows his time is short. And that was such a heartbreaking moment. I'd say even more so than the tragedy at the end. It's just, it's a very special movie that can play so many emotional chords and tug at those heartstrings, but never feel like a downer. I don't consider this movie a downer. It's a tearjerker for sure, but I don't feel depressed after watching it.
You know you're doing something right, and I want to focus on the Laura Dern character. When he's at camp and he's in a place that he feels even more comfortable in his own skin than what he really is. At this moment, when they're building this chemistry, I completely ignored and forgot of the deformity of Rocky. It was almost like a normal character. You can take away the deformity and it wouldn't have mattered because the chemistry and the believability is there. That's how you know the writing is on point and the performances by Schultz is on point, because it just felt real. It felt like I was watching a normal drama where there's nothing that in appearance separates Rocky from everybody else. And that is due to the brilliant writing and the performance from Schultz. So I think that's where the magic is in this, is the movie's intent is to show us that on appearance, it means absolutely nothing. And that is the biggest challenge. It is so easy to go all in on deformity and make it kind of just the focus aspect. And I'll talk about it later, but we saw that in Powder in the 90s, that really to make that a focal point of a film. But here, the intent is to show normality and to show life is life. And you can still have that energetic free spirit. You can have that once, just like the next person. So to me, that is the beauty in this film. And to me, this isn't a movie about deformity. It's a movie about life. It's a movie about living life to the fullest. And we all wear masks. And that doesn't go for just Rocky. It's every character here. And that's why it's so earned.
I agree with you on that. And I think the other thing that it's about is community. Because, like I said, we don't see a lot of the outside world. We see the students at Rocky's first school, who, of course, just like everyone else, make fun of his face. Hey, take your mask off, blah, blah, blah. But then he earns their respect. He is a genius. He tutors them. And when it comes to graduation, he's just one of the kids. Everyone likes him, which is hard for him to go to a new school where he meets new people. And that's, I think, the first step of what's dragging him down physically and emotionally. It's like, I have to do this all over again. I have to impress a whole new crowd of people so they see past the exterior. And again, well-written, well-performed. If there is a cliche that I don't like in this movie, and it's not even I don't like it, it's just we saw a lot of it, especially in this decade. It's the, oh, my parents won't accept you cliche, right? We saw it with Daniel LaRusso and The Karate Kid, right? In that sense, it was a class war thing. And then we saw it in La Bamba, where it was a racial thing, where Donna's parents don't want her dating a Latino. And in this one, it's her parents not giving her letters or phone calls because he is a differently abled, deformed person. That cliche is kind of run dry, but they don't take too much time on it. So I think it gives it a pass, and it builds the drama for that person in the audience who's expecting that, right? It's not full on hand-holding. It's just that little nudge to be like, okay, this guy's life is harder and it's going to be worth it when they have that reconnection later on in the film, which it does. It works. It adds up to it.
I 100% agree. And I think if I were to take anything back, it would be not focusing too much on that, because they don't focus a lot of time with it, but I think they do focus too much time on it. When it comes to the first interaction, we see the facial expressions. We see the obvious shock factor of the parents. Leave it there and have a reconnect later. We don't need to have the over-explanation. You missed my calls or you missed my letters, whatever it may be. Just we can read the room. We can read these characters on what's going to happen next. And that would be the hand-holding piece of it. And it is a little bit cliche. But to defend it a little bit is, it needed to have a transition to kind of have an excuse to push Rocky back to the love, back to the rekindling. And I think that is the easy route. And I agree that this could have gone a little bit more strategic in how they plan that, because like I said earlier, it did a great job on at that point, making him or making the audience feel like we've forgotten the deformity. And then it just re-brings it up. And I think that loses a little bit of the magic in terms of cliche. So I think that could have been handled a little bit different. I think there are smarter things they could have done when it comes to how those two reconnect.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, it's an amazing movie. I think that over the years it's been slept on and maybe a little underappreciated because it wasn't a big award winner. And I think at the end of the day, people think of it for one specific reason, and that is a deformity, which kind of ties into our critiques from Siskel and Ebert because they mention it a lot. Now, before we get into the video, I really think that this is a very fascinating critique from both of them because they spend so much time on it. And we talked about this a few episodes ago, that we always know they're excited to film when they just can't stop talking about the movie before they even get into whether they liked it or not, where they just want to cover the bases of here's the plot, here are the characters, here's what's going on with it socially, this is what, you know, audiences have been thinking so far, this is what the studio's been doing with it. Anytime they go into that much detail about a film before they give their true opinion of it means you're in for a good conversation, and this one is none different than that. So Gene brought this to the episode.
Mask is probably going to be known as sort of an adolescent elephant man telling the true story of a badly deformed California teenage boy who has a grotesque lion-like face, but who otherwise is a model youngster, brilliant in school, collects baseball cards, and is very devoted to his mother. And his mother is a remarkable character in her own right. She's played by Cher in another surprisingly effective performance by the former pop singer. The boy's mother is a tough-talking motorcycle club mama, and she is absolutely devoted to her child. She knows there is no reason, for example, why her son Rocky can't attend a public junior high school. Unfortunately, in a rather crass marketing move, Universal Pictures is not releasing any pictures or scenes from the movie Mask that show the boy. They just edit him out, edit his face out. But that attitude is really unconscionable for this film, because this that attitude treats this movie as if it were some kind of carnival freak show. You're only going to pay your $5. That's the only way you're going to see this kid. But that's not the kind of picture this is. This isn't a freak show picture. On the contrary, Mask asks us to confront physical deformity head on, face to face, realize that it isn't the big deal that we think it is, that we should be looking at people's hearts, not their faces.
I'm old enough to remember when this hit the theater, but I did not see it in the theater. I don't remember the marketing for it. I remember seeing it on VHS probably the year after it came out in the theater with my mom, and then it just became like a regular thing. She's a huge Cher fan. She loved this movie, therefore I was immersed in it. Now I love it. But yeah, I agree. The fact that, and I went and looked at some of the old trailers, he's not wrong. Like, they do shoot Rocky from behind and you hear his voice, but you don't see his face. So that is a very disingenuous way to market a film. I am not sure if it's 100% what he's saying, where it's like, oh, we want people to pay the money so they can actually see how hideous he is. I think more of like it was probably a studio exec saying, hey, we don't want to scare audiences from this movie. And if they don't understand the context, that might do it. Remember, back then, movies were all about commercials and print work. It wasn't like today where like that face would sell a million tickets. It was a different world back then. So I maybe disagree with what he thinks the studio's motives were, but where I appreciate him is the fact that he's defending the movie and saying, hey, the whole point of this movie is that we can see past this face, so why aren't we marketing it as that kind of film? In the trailers, they really do market it as Cher's struggles with drug addiction and defending her son more than the son's story. Again, we're seeing marketing tell the story, and the movie is a completely different package than what the studio is selling. Maybe that's why it didn't get the recognition theatrically that it should have, because it was mismarketed.
I'm going to clarify before I go into this. So, to be clear, the intent of the studios, 100%, absolutely, I'll just make the assumption, this was to gain curiosity, to get people in the seats to see a sideshow, in Gene's words. So I get that. So I don't think he's 100% wrong when it comes to the intent of what the studios are trying to do. which is to put butts in the seat based on something right. that we haven't seen. But if I want to go to the tradition of what this movie is trying to do and soften the blow a little bit, I would say that the marketing looking back is almost a beautiful thing, because even though the intent's ugly, the marketing now would seem, if we were to get to know somebody for the first time and we are to see somebody on the screen, the human nature is judge on appearance. That's what human nature is. And then they speak, we get to know, we learn, and we warm up. So to me, I think it was great marketing, because this warmed me up to this movie. The first time we see Schultz on screen, yeah, it's a snap where we're focusing on the looks, but as the movie goes on, like I said earlier, we're warming up. We're getting to know him. We're getting to know the other characters, and we love all the other characters. So I think the trailer does do it justice to what the filmmaker's intent is, even though the Hollywood intent is the greedy bastards.
Yeah, like trying to cover it up a little bit to not scare people away. And, you know, I think one of the things, too, that he definitely mentions in this is that this is a decade of dramas, and the cliche of dramas is already parodied. It was parodied on Saturday Night Live. Tracy Ullman show used to do it, you know, like, oh, we're going to go and cry now. We're going to go see a cry movie. We're going to go see Beaches, right? That is what the 80s were really all about. And you can tell that he's really trying hard to make sure that audiences know that this is a differentiator for this kind of genre, that there's more to it than that. He goes on because he has a lot to say about this film.
This is one of the most beautiful love stories we've had in the movies in quite a long time, the love story between the mother and the son. Mask pulls out all the stops in the story. You could see it in that scene, giving Cher not only a lot of emotion, but also a drug problem to beat. It also gives the boy Rocky a love affair at his summer camp with a blind girl. Now, I presume all of this is true. It's based on a true story, we're told. It has to be true, because no writer, I think, would have dared to make all of this up. But more important, Mask is a beautiful film that should trigger all sorts of wonderful, tender thoughts as we watch the story of two unforgettable characters, the mother, as played by Cher, and Rocky, played so effectively in a mask by Eric Stoltz. I was genuinely touched by Mask.
Yeah, and I forgot to even mention that the chemistry between the two of them is so good, because I was too busy talking about the chemistry between, like, the romantic people in the movie. Let's not forget that this really is a mother and son story, and you know, I like Eric Stoltz. I don't think he's a bad actor, but I think that sometimes it's easier for certain actors to perform better behind a mask or behind some kind of facade. Now, we have to just mention really fast that this would have been the film that he made directly before Back to the Future, in which he was fired from after, like, what, 6-7 weeks of shooting, for being too serious and not funny enough in the role of Marty McFly. So here he comes from this film where he has to be a very dramatic person, yet he has to almost over-emote to get through the prosthetic makeup, but it pulls it off. I wonder if maybe he was just pulling too much of that energy. He hasn't shaken it off as he goes into Marty McFly and totally, from what we hear, misinterpret that character. Because what a back-to-back double hitter that would have been, is if he would have had this film and then Back to the Future right behind it. Alas, that didn't happen, but I have zero complaints about his performance in this film. In fact, I have a hard time thinking of any other actor from this era that would have been as convincing in that role as Eric Stoltz was. I'm not saying they don't exist. I have a hard time just thinking of one that could do better.
100% agree, because we've had this conversation before where it's easier to go comedy to drama than dramedy to comedy, because it's hard. Yeah. It really tests an actor's range to really transition. And Schultz is a young actor at this point. So it is really hard, even for the most experienced actor, to really transition to that aspect. So I think if I had to pick between the two, I wouldn't change a thing in Schultz's career when it comes to, would I want him in Back to the Future or Mask, because Mask, he nails it. And Michael J. Fox nailed it in Back to the Future, because Fox was going comedy to comedy. It was an easy transition for him. Here, he can really make this role believable, even under those prosthetics, which is, I should say, is brave for a movie in the 80s to really go after the emotional element with prosthetics and make that a dramatic piece. So without going too cliche that we spoke to earlier. So I think Schultz did an amazing job when it comes to making it believable, but also how the chemistry is built between all the characters. It is so hard to build energy and make it believable when you're caked with prosthetics and makeup and not make it feel goofy, make it feel just totally outlandish. And he does it. So this was the forte in his career. But if he would have nailed Back to the Future, that would have been a whole different ball game in the test to his range. And we would have seen more of Schultz going into the future.
I was too, Gene. And you know, this is a wonderful example of a couple of comebacks, because both Peter Bogdanovich and Cher have been trashed over the last 4 or 5 years with various misfortunes they've had in their professional careers. Mm-hmm. Here's a comeback for both of them, a great picture with a great performance. And Cher, after Comeback to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, and after Silkwood, and now this picture, where did she come from?
I know.
She was a has-been singer, and now suddenly she's one of our best dramatic actresses.
And picking this, interesting projects.
And interesting projects, and her relationship with the kid, and the kid's performance. Eric Stoltz is so good in this film. I looked at the way that he looked for about 10 seconds. I thought, gee, that's too bad. And then after that, I was captivated by the person inside, by the performance
and
inside,
all you're seeing is mouth. All you're seeing is mouth, and he's wearing dentures and eyeballs. Let me say, we get jaded real easy in this job. We see everything, and heart wrenching pictures that are supposed to be. My guard goes up.
Usually,
this
when
broke
the,
through.
Usually, when I see a picture that's supposed to break my heart, my first impulse is to start laughing at it because I know it's going to be cornball.
Yeah, this was not. It was touching, and I'll tell you this. Here's a good test of a picture like this. You say, well, you like it because who's going to pick on a film about a crippled kid? Mm-hmm. Well, I say this. You take that crippled kid out of this picture, put a normal face on him, and you still have a very good picture because the relationship between mother and son is interesting, and the mother's network of all her motorcycle gang friends, that's interesting too. So it's not doing it just with that face. It's doing it with a terrific screenplay.
Not at all, and I think you're right to say that they should have shown the face on the screen, because you might think at home, gee, he's going to look so horrible that I won't be able to enjoy the picture. Actually, the soul of this kid and the physical appearance of him in his own way, he's very beautiful.
So yeah, they both agree about it. And what Gene says at the end, I mean, modern day political correct language aside, he's 100% right. The script, the story, the direction, and the acting is good enough that this could have just been about poor people. It could have been about a poor kid who's looking for baseball cards and his mom's a drug addict, and it still would have worked, right? Like, it's just that good of a script. It's that good of a project. And yeah, I'm so happy that they both liked this, because I hadn't watched this review when I picked it. I just knew it was out there. I don't like to watch it too soon, especially before I pick a movie to put on the list, because I don't want to feel jaded or biased about what their opinion is. And oh, now I really want to talk about it. Literally didn't watch this review until yesterday. And it was so refreshing, because there was a part of me where I was afraid that they were going to say it was cliche. And I had like an argument ready to battle them. Like, no, it's not cliche. This is the like counter drama tearjerker for all the other ones that came out in the 80s. And that's exactly what they're saying. So we needed this. We needed some justification to a film that deserved that credibility from them, and not them picking apart a film that literally has nothing to pick apart.
I loved the part of Gene where he loved it so much, where he had to be upfront and honest. Hey, we have these emotional movies, and I usually have a wall. This one broke through that wall. I love that. And that's something we don't see from these two quite that often, saying we have a dramatic piece. We know we're critics. We know we're going to kind of poke fun at it if we see something wrong, but this, I'm telling you, is something that works. And it really truly does, because you said it, they said it, and I'm gonna say it again. You can again take any prosthetics off and it will be believable. It will be engaging, it will be entertaining, and it will be effective, because it's not about that. And it's all about the intent of what the filmmakers went to do, is take the deformity out of it and talk about the beauty of the inside. Talk about the beauty of life. Talk about the beauty of relationships. Because even when we get to Sharon Sam Elliott's character, that could have gone. We know there's conflict there and it could have focused on that, but it really doesn't. It focused on the rekindling of it, the redemption of the relationship. And this movie is purely about inner beauty. And Roger said it, and that perfects his critique on it. It's just a beautiful movie that doesn't follow all the tropes. We do have snippets, yes, but at the end of the day, like Roger said, it's just a beautiful movie.
And I think it's worth mentioning that to get people familiar with this timeline of where we're at in Cher's career, she only had two movies before this one. She had Come Back to the Five and Dine, Jimmy Dean, which she said, and then Silkwood, and then Mask in 1985. So she was not a film icon yet. She still had Witches of Eastwick, Suspect, Moonstruck, all in the same year. All in 1987, those three films came out and made her a cinema icon, followed by Mermaids, followed by The Player, and then more Robert Altman movies with Ready to Wear. And then, boom, she is the rebirth of Cher in the late 90s, early 2000s. I mean, she is such an icon, but we think of her like from when she was doing the variety show with Sonny, when she was doing all these guest spots on sitcoms back in the day. This is only her third theatrical film. Knocks it out of the park. And then only builds that success. So for people that are not as old as we are or don't remember, that's a huge deal to think of that timeline. When they're speaking about this, her, when they say a washed up pop star, that's what she was in 1985. She was still like an icon, but the idea, it'd be like if Whitney Houston had a huge movie career, which she didn't. She had like two movies, you know, but here we go. Cher just took off. So yeah, I think it's really interesting to go back and think about where this is on the timeline. And is a studio going to say, all right, let's make a movie with Cher? Okay. You know, I just think it's really fascinating. So at the end of the day, I mean, obviously this movie, it's a 5-star movie in Letterboxd for me. It's one of the rare ones. It's just so good. And for the critique, I can't find any flaws. So this is going to be one of the rare A's for Gene in my book.
So this is where I wish I had Gene, because I would 100% agree with you. But when it comes to Roger, I agree with everything that he says. But this is the hard part, is this was a Gene show. He nailed all the key points. And what really set me back a little bit with Roger, and it just kind of stays in my mind, is calling Cher a has-been. And that, right, to me, really did stick with me, because it's not about what you've done. It's about what you're doing and how you've grown. That should be the primary focus in this, is not bring up the negatives, but how good she is, not how bad she was in a previous role or a previous career. It doesn't matter. Focus on the performance. So I'm still going to say he nails all the points, though, but he's going to get a little bit nicked off. I'm going to give him 3.5 stars.
You know, and I think this is a time where we did not see a lot of pop star crossover into mainstream cinema. You know, we had our divas, we had Barbara Streisand, who could do both, but we did not really have that many Oscar caliber performances from former pop singers. I mean, to this day, we really don't either. Not everyone can be Lady Gaga, you know, not everyone can do both. They try, but most of them come off like Jennifer Lopez, who's on both, right? So I get it. I get the jadedness of the critics of this time, because it wasn't something they really saw. But at the same time, it's like, just appreciate the performance. We don't have to be negative about where it came from, right? So I agree with you 100% on that. Cool, cool. Well, this was a breath of fresh air. I mean, I knew the movie was good, but to hear them speak highly about a movie that I like, it really makes the whole thing worthwhile, because there are some episodes we do, man, where it's like, I don't know what to say about their critique without totally talking shit about them for the next 20 minutes, you know? And again, who am I? I'm just like a movie podcaster, right? But I feel a lot of those grievances I have are justified, because I don't think that they are doing their best work or paying real attention to what the critique should have been based on what the movie or the performance represented. This one, they nailed it all because they liked it. And they always speak more about movies they like. So, yep, that's where I am with that one.
I think this one was a breath of fresh air when it comes to the movie and the review, because this is one, the movie makes you feel good, the review makes you feel good, because they nail everything to just land the message of just the pure beauty of it. And I love the fact that they both acknowledge it together and they can agree on what the intent of the movie was trying to do. So to me, it was a beautiful review for a beautiful movie.
Right. Well, we're going to have to appreciate what we just talked about, because the next few movies on the list are going to be a little bit more challenging. So next up, to celebrate the big dinosaur movie coming out theatrically, we are going to be covering their review of the Roger Corman produced film Carnosaur, which came out in 1993, pretty much piggybacking off of Jurassic Park, as they do. And yeah, this is definitely a cult film. This is more in my realm than yours generally. But I'm curious to know what you think of this movie, because we've never talked about it. It was either going to be this or Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend, and we went with this instead, which I'm actually kind of glad, because I like Baby, but Carnosaur is worth the revisit. So stay tuned for that.
This one, what put me over the edge is this one almost seems like an Antonio movie, but I'm not sure. So, but this one, I'll be curious on, and I'll be curious about the revisit, because I haven't watched it in years.
Right. Well, I'm excited to see the egg laying scene again, if you know what I'm talking about. All right. So here we go. Everyone, make sure you like, listen, review, and subscribe to our show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you find your audio podcasts. Make sure you subscribe to our channel on YouTube and leave a nice review, share it with your friends. And if there's any films that you would like to hear us talk about that Siskel and Ebert reviewed on their show, let us know either in the comments of YouTube or in the comments of the podcast catcher. And then we are also on Instagram. You can find me at thecultworthy.com. I am the host of the Cultworthy Cinema Podcast. And you can find my friend Justin over at
themoviewire.com.
Great episode, Justin. I will see you next week.
See you next week.